The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the program. My guest is Scott Moldavin. He's been a longtime friend of the organization, a personal friend of Jeff Dorman's as well. Scott Moldavin is senior advisor to Delos, a pioneer of wellness real estate and a founder of The Well, that's W-E-L-L, Building Standard, for the past 8 years as executive director of the Green Building Finance Consortium and senior fellow at the Rocky Mountain Institute. Scott Moldavin has led the movement to scale sustainable property investment by fully integrating health, wellness, productivity, and other benefits beyond energy cost savings and into sustainable property investment decisions. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing? Looking forward to talking with you.
Doing well, and we are glad to have you on board for this particular subject. This is an interesting subject because I want to go back in time for starters a little bit, Scott, because many years ago, I remember hearing over the television about sick building syndrome, which is, of course, the antithesis of what you're talking about with wellness, well buildings. So let's talk about sick building syndrome. What is it? How is it discovered? And why don't you also kind of run through the scenario of what happens to people in a sick or unhealthy building? How do the symptoms manifest, or what type of symptoms manifest that are indicative of sick building syndrome?
Okay, well, sick building syndrome is really just one part of what a healthy building is, but it was back in the late 1970s, people in new homes and new offices started getting some symptoms like the nausea, dizziness, headaches, eye or skin irritation or a dry cough, and they started calling it an office illness. And back in 1986, the World Health Organization first coined the term sick building syndrome. And what makes it interesting is sick building syndrome is when you have those symptoms, but there is not a specific illness or cause. You might also remember Legionnaire's disease back in Philadelphia. That was in 1976 when 29 people died. That was also raised a lot of attention to the issue. But that was really, they actually know what caused that, which was Legionella bacteria. Anyways, the courts got involved, and eventually the ASHRAE, which is the engineering and heating and HVAC people, they developed a quality standard. Anyway, so that's the sick building syndrome. But what happens to people in sick buildings actually goes a bit beyond that. You do have the symptoms I mentioned with the sick building syndrome, but also respiratory problems because of low ventilation rates or mold or humidity or toxins. You have sleep problems because of bad nutrition or lighting or other kinds of issues. Obesity is a big issue. Stress and heart disease and strokes. Diabetes, all these things, mental health problems, they're all the kinds of things that can be generated in a sick or unhealthy building.
Did you say obesity?
Obesity, yes. It's a major problem in the United States. And without thinking about fitness and getting people moving and nutritional things and things like that, obesity, and also obesity is directly tied to sleep problems, which can be tied to lighting and other things. So what we've learned in recent times is how connected a lot of these issues are, but really the primary chronic diseases that really are about 75% of the cost of healthcare in the U.S. are driven by, at their base, by some issues in buildings.
Okay, well, in all of this, we want to talk about the wellness real estate. Scott, I want to talk about what you're working on right now, what Delos is working on, and I want our listeners to understand that this is all tied into investment. It's all tied into return on investment and stabilizing investment and whatnot. But first, we really want to create that foundation. You said that wellness real estate goes beyond what sick building syndrome was about. Why don't you explain to us, if a building is actually achieving wellness, what does it have going for it?
Okay, so interestingly, prior to the creation of the well-building standard, which became active about 2 years ago, the office well-building standard, there really wasn't a standard of what a healthy building was. The kinds of things in the well-building standard are... you have things like where you have the indoor air quality, you have ventilation, you're controlling mold, CO2 concentrations. With lighting, it could be things like circadian lighting, which what we can talk about, or task lighting, or dealing with color and glare. For water, you have there's like, what do they say, 50 or 60% of the people are dehydrated on a regular basis, which cause a lot of problems, particularly with productivity and other kinds of diseases. And particularly in the building interiors, we have a lot of things that aren't covered by green building standards, things like ergonomics and acoustics and biophilia, another interesting thing, basically that people do a lot better when they have running water and views and a variety, actually 14 other different types of biophilic things. So there's a lot of different things, 102 interventions that are actually covered in the well-building standard all around these topics.
That's amazing, 102 interventions. You mentioned acoustics. Elaborate on acoustics a little bit.
So one of the things that we, that as the office buildings environments have been changing, and we have a lot more open offices. Acoustic problems have been getting that's people noise. You know, noise as a distraction has been shown in studies to reduce productivity by 66%. It's not surprising for people that have worked in a spot where they don't deal with it. So the well-building standard can deal with acoustic issues through surfaces, through making sure that printers are not, and copy machines and other noisy machines are properly separated or ventilated, and dealing with policies and behavioral things internally. But there's a lot of things dealing with the kind of tiles, ceiling tiles. There's a whole bunch of different interventions related to acoustics that can help solve that problem.
You know, Scott, when you think about how exhausting it is when you take a long plane flight and all the ambient noise that goes on, I have a friend who got noise-canceling headphones, and he said that once he started wearing those on flights, his energy level was tremendously higher when he got to the other end of the flight. So when you think about the average office building, and if you do have bad acoustics and there's a lot of noise going on and you're in there 8 or 10 hours a day, I can imagine that workers become exhausted without realizing what the cause of that exhaustion is. They may just be thinking, I have too much work to do, or the work is too exacting, or what have you.
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of issues that, and what we've learned in the studying the healthy buildings a lot more in recent years is how interconnected a lot of these different interventions are, dealing with both the indoor air quality and lighting and ergonomics, that they together can produce these kinds of positive results.
So let's focus on lighting for just a minute. I've heard the famous study from Ford Motor Company, were on the production floor. They said we could use more lighting. They increased the lighting, and they were more productive. And in the end, the study just figured out that what really was making them more productive was management was paying attention to them, and it boosted morale and whatnot. But nonetheless, fluorescent lighting versus full-spectrum lighting is a world apart, or having natural light. So what are some of the interventions with regard to lighting? Is it natural light and full-spectrum bulbs?
Interesting. As you might expect, lighting has been one of the most studied issues for a long time. You know, daylighting is a really important issue. There's been scores of studies, a lot of them with the Carnegie Mellon, where they've shown over 5% increase in productivity just by putting in daylighting. That's something that's been used before. A new piece of research, really just in the last 10 years, has been circadian lighting. Circadian lighting, as you might, from some early class in your education, that's essentially light that's in the morning, helps you wake up, and then lighting, as the lighting changes, you actually get ready for bed. In the morning, they've actually determined scientifically that both on the angle and the number of lumens in the light and the way that it's put out, that the lighting actually produces cortisone, which energizes you, keeps you productive during the day, and then it gets you ready for sleep by producing melatonin in the evening. So, wow, there's a, they've come up with this great science. Also with, you have the offices, you know, that have gotten a lot more open offices, and you have offices with different types of functions in them. Getting task lighting right, making sure that you're putting the right lighting for the right type of activity, right? So if you're on a computer screen, you need a different lighting than if you're working on, you know, on something else or in a conference room with people. So task lighting is important. Color of lighting is important. So there's, you know, over 15 interventions related to a lighting alone. And every single intervention in this well-building standard, you can actually tie it to the science that actually is behind each intervention.
So circadian lighting, like human circadian rhythms, very interesting. We have a couple employees here, Scott, who keep their light off in their office. They have no natural light. There's no windows in their office, and they keep their light off, or they keep it very dimly lit. What does that tell you?
It tells you that they don't need that light. They don't need all that light, and that they're naturally trying to do it that way. So yeah, no, it's also important to keep flexibility, right? One of our seven areas where interventions are in the well-building standard is the mind, right? Giving people control and flexibility, and transparency in the way you do things. There's a variety of things relative to behavior that can also be important.
So what is the health of the average office or retail building or warehouse? So on average, are buildings deplorably unhealthy, or do they tend to just be, you know, not optimized in a way they could be?
All right, so the issue is we don't actually know. Until we had a well building standard, we know from some OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, they control some of the worst things like high levels of formaldehyde or whatever, but in general there hasn't really been a way for people to know whether buildings are healthy. LEED and green and BREEAM and other green building certifications dealt with a few things, but they only are in a small number of buildings, except perhaps with large institutional offices. The issues that I'm not a doctor and I haven't tested every building, but I'm going to say, you know, on the margin, buildings can promote health a lot. And so if you're in a building, it's, you know, the kinds of things where the issues that are persisting still, even in almost all buildings today, is some sort of ventilation problem. Mold, which you can deal with in some cases. One of the issues is carbon dioxide concentrations are higher because buildings have gotten tighter. But buildings haven't dealt with lighting in the appropriate way. So on the margin, they're not sleeping as well, they're more stressed, and they're not as productive. Are they, you know, is it a life or death thing? I don't know if it's life or death, but dehydration can have negative effects on you, and acoustics and ergonomics and things like that. Anyway, so there's a lot. So I'm not going to say I would say that on average that buildings that we don't know, but buildings have not been designed and operated in a way to maximize and promote health. So there's a lot of health that's left on the table, and potentially some exposure to some things that would, over the long term, be really bad for you.
Okay, so let's say a building owner comes to Delos and says, I got 500 people in my building. I want to retrofit this building so that it meets the wellness real estate standard, the well-building standard, I should say. And if I make this investment, to begin with, what kind of scale of investment are we talking about retrofitting a building? And secondly, what's the result going to be? What kind of payback do I get on that?
All right, so let's think about that. So let's talk about the first one you talked about. You think about payback. If you're a corporate real estate person, that would be somebody who owns a building and then they have their own employees in there. The kinds of investments that you're making, it's going to vary a lot by building, but in general, the WELL building standard is not about major hard costs or major you know, big expensive things. It's about, you know, the getting the standards, doing the professional services, changing policies, and then doing some of those things. The numbers can vary anywhere from maybe 50 cents a square foot to $2 a square foot, something like that. It can depend a lot. But anyways, the cost by any measure of sanity is nothing. When you look at all the different just the interventions that affect productivity, there's a whole bunch of them that affect productivity, from ergonomic desks, which have been shown in a recent Texas A&M study that in two call centers, this is just amazing, they're almost the same. In one, they gave them a desk that adjust, and they measured their calls for 6 months. And after 6 months, everything else being equal, the building with adjustable desks had 46% higher productivity based on number of calls. I mean, that's crazy. There is scores of studies about indoor air quality and productivity, and numbers, you know, average near 10%. Daylighting, I mentioned the 5.5%, and acoustics. So you're talking, when you do all these interventions, it's a little hard to say, well, how much can I attribute to the WELL building standard? But what I can tell you that is, if you assume an increase in productivity of 1%, I just mentioned all those single interventions with really high productivity numbers, that you have a return on investment of 100% or more. So it can be highly, highly beneficial. Another actually easier way to even think about the finances for a corporation is that there's been a tremendous increase in wellness spending by big and even medium-sized companies. On average, about $700 per person per year is spent on wellness. That's like, you know, lab testing and smoking and gym incentives and education and those kinds of things. What they found is that $700 per person per year has not been very effective. Most people don't participate, and they haven't really been able to time for health. I can tell you now that with an investment of maybe $100 to $400 per person one time, you can have a WELL building standard, which has a whole series of health and wellness things that passively make your people healthier. And so it's extremely cost effective from that perspective. Whenever I go and talk to corporate real estate people, I always have them bring their human resources person, because they end up making the case for me. So from an investor perspective, it's a little bit different, right? Because you can only monetize this potential interest by occupants or tenants if you can raise rents and increase retention or absorption or occupancy, things like that. But there is again, if you look at, and there's lots of evidence related from occupancy and tenant surveys by the large number of tenants that are already involved in the WELL building standard, from Microsoft and McKesson and Wells Fargo, and, you know, 7 of the top 10 tech companies and major banks in the world, engineering companies, just a whole slew of tenants all over the world. We have, we're 350 projects that are registered or certified in 27 countries. So there's already a strong demand. So as an investor, it's really, at this point, we're new in the game, but it's a function of being defensive. If you want to get those premier quality tenants, and again, only having to have really small changes in rents or occupancies based on that increased demand, you can do really, really well. And the best evidence available probably is really a proxy, which has been 10 or 15 studies about how green buildings, which include some health and wellness things, how they affect building profitability. And sort of the average of all those studies is maybe rents are moved 3 to 6%, occupancies maybe 10%, maybe overall value 5 to 10%. And so that's for all sustainability attributes, not just health and wellness. But when you think about the 102 interventions and how focused the WELL building standard is on health and wellness, I don't know what the numbers are, but they're certainly the profitability is really more getting the people that make the value decisions to make the decisions, and not just focusing on costs.
You recently gave a presentation titled Buildings Emerge as Drivers of Health, Well-being, and Profits. Explain that title with an emphasis on the profits portion of the title. We were talking about, you know, a corporate building and somebody saying, these are my people, this is my building, I want to retrofit it. But then there's also the people who are control funds and want a corporate compound or campus built. There's the institutional investors. There's the you know, high net worth investors who are part of private equity funds and such. What about that?
All right. So yeah. Probably, I think one thing as a real estate person, again, you didn't mention in my background, but I've co-founded an investment management company called Guggenheim Real Estate, and I was a pension consultant. I ran real estate consulting at Deloitte. So I've done a lot of stuff in real estate. And I've been doing this for 35 years, and when I got into the research on what a building can do to improve health, I had an epiphany, which was amazing, which is that with intent and a very small amount of money, you could actually create space that is more healthy mentally and physically for people. So I think you have to start there. That is an amazing statement, if it's true, and I think it is. But my real title is, the big question is, why healthy buildings today, right? And there's a couple of things. This growing business interest I talked to you about, over 90% of people have of businesses have health and wellness programs now, and that's been growing. It's also been growing on the consumer side. We also have the fact of the standards themselves. Now we have the ability to measure and verify, not just with the WELL Building Standard, but even benchmarks like the Global Real Estate Sustainability Benchmark called GRESB. They have also, as of 2 years ago, have a health and wellness module showing that it's starting to become something that the institutional investor community is concerned about. Also, the another really interesting thing is this kind of tying technology. We're at a point in time where we've had all this science done. Really, there's been really hundreds and hundreds of studies over the last 10 or 15, 20, 25 years about things you can do in buildings that create health and wellness. So why are things happening today? And let me give you a couple of examples. We've had a recent study, probably the most important study related to buildings and health, that came out in September of 2016, I think it was. Anyways, what they found is that with higher levels of carbon dioxide, that you have significant declines in cognition. And why it's so important is that the way they measured this cognition was around the kind of things that white-collar people do, like research and information searching and writing and analysis. And so this study showed, they actually did the first study in 2002 that laid out that this was happening, and then the one that they just completed in the last year or so, done by Harvard and Syracuse, a very controlled experiment, they actually found that if you control, have a regular building, and then you improve the level of ventilation, CO2 concentrations, and volatile organic compounds, and just looking at those three things, that the buildings that were had the highest levels, the best performance in those, had 101% increase in cognitive function, whereas the buildings that were sort of in between the control and the best one had a 61%. And so that's amazing science, similar to the circadian lion science, which lighting science, which shows this incredible stuff going on. But the thing about today is we now have, with technology, we have now have sensors, we have digital controls, we have better materials, we can now develop circadian lighting. And so the technology is meeting up with the science, allowing cost-effective and practical ways to actually address some of these things.
You know, it's amazing. I read a book years ago by a guy named Richard Sutphin. It was called Unseen Influences. I believe that was the title, Unseen Influences. He was a spiritualist, but the book was also about all the different chemicals, compounds, and elements that are around us that affect us. And just listening to you talk, Scott, it reminds us that there's tremendous number of forces at play at all times and in all situations. A lot of times we're completely clueless about, but fortunately, science and research observation and whatnot has helped us zero in a little bit. So the well-building standard, I assume the idea is that it will one day be like the LEED standard, like LEED for building construction and sustainability. An effort's being made to integrate. Is that, why wouldn't you guys just say, let's integrate that as part of the LEED standard? Since LEED is so well understood, why wouldn't Delos just decide, let's integrate these other components into LEED rather than run parallel?
And that's an excellent question. And it kind of gets to, like many things in business related to how this thing was developed. You had a couple of entrepreneurial brothers, Pete and Paul Shalia from Goldman Sachs, who wanted to marry this real estate and this health industry. And so they started looking into it. They ended up spending $30 or $40 million to develop this well-building standard. They worked very closely with LEED. Rick Fedrizzi, who is the head of the U.S. Green Building Council, actually recently just resigned and took over the International Well Building Institute. He's so interested in this stuff. And what they decided, because LEED and the green building community have been trying to deal with this healthy buildings issue for many, many years, but they really just didn't have the capacity to invest to get all the scientific work done. I mean, Delos worked with Harvard and Columbia and the Mayo Clinic and the Cleveland Clinic and many other scientists and practitioners in this to put this all together. They took it really seriously. And I think whenever you deal with health, and Delos is really, they understand the responsibility if you're dealing with health and making health these kinds of trying to improve health, you have to do it in a really serious way. So I think it was really the fact that it was that LEED really just couldn't get the investment done. But what has been done, both not just with LEED, but with BREEAM and Green Star and other major rating systems around the world, is that the international, they work really closely. And so there's they've even developed a lot of the implementation methodologies so they can do them simultaneously, then you can do them together, and they fit together in the same sort of process and policy. So it's... your question makes sense. It just didn't develop that way, but there's a lot of coordination among them.
Interesting. So I don't know if you could possibly answer this question, Scott, but how many buildings meet the WELL building standard today, or is it just so new that and just getting off the ground that to where there's not a real accounting of this?
Well, you know, it is so new, and it's just getting off the ground. There's 380 buildings that are registered certified, maybe about 70 million square feet. Again, it's major building owners and major occupants that are doing this. And the office building standards up. We have a multifamily standard or retail standards. We're working with schools and hospitality. So there's been a lot of investment in getting this thing underway, and these buildings are out there, but it's at the starting point, but it's moving quickly, even to the point where a place like Australia is an interesting one for people that know Australia. It's a relatively small market, but they have a lot of big players, and so the WELL building standard, maybe for competitive reasons, has been adopted by most of the major investment managers there. And Deloitte, who just recently went out for a major space request, I actually specified the need that they had to be in a WELL building. And so I think for the health of all of us, we're hoping that the WELL building standard, that the model of Australia where it becomes more something common, something that tenants are going to want, I think that's the way that it's going to move, and it's going to move quickly.
Well, how big a role are new technologies going to play in the advancement of clean and healthy buildings? What are some of the technologies today, and do you see some horizon technologies that will come to market in the near future that you think are going to facilitate the effort being made here?
Technologies are very important. I mentioned some of the ones, all the sensors and the digital controls related to the circadian lighting and the carbon dioxide. You have an interesting one, even surfaces and materials. I don't know, the CBRE office in Los Angeles was the first well building standard office to be done. And at CBRE, they've also had the open offices. And one of the unintended consequences of open offices is that people that are sick, they move all around and they can get other people sick. Because of a technology innovation where you can actually have a surface where the cleaners come over at night and they run a UV light over these surfaces and it kills all the bacteria. Simple things like the movable desks and the dynamic desks. But I think as far as our horizon technology, I think what it is going to be sensors and digital controls. In fact, sensors, because if you're a building owner and you think about it, it's like, do I really want to know how healthy my building is? Because then I have to act, or do I, you know, I don't really, you know, there's been a reluctance in some respects for people to want to know that. The technology that's going to be revolutionary, that's already there, is instead of you figuring out and managing how healthy your building is, your tenants and every individual with their Fitbits. I have this great slide where there's six or seven new wearable technologies that are going to be able to test the air and the lighting and you know, you're really not going to be able to hide from these kinds of health issues, and they're going. And there's tremendous amount. The volume of research in healthy buildings has you know multiplied five times over the last you know 10 or 15 years. There's so many new things going out. Can you imagine like a secondhand smoke study? Remember when secondhand smoke study came and all of a sudden they banned smoking? That was a huge impact. So I'm not, you know, other than the technology and the sensors and being able to actually measure and fine-tune your buildings more, I think there's going to be a whole combination of smaller technology innovations that are going to be really important.
One more question, Scott, and it has to do with color. I understand, I don't know if I'm going to get this right, but color has a great effect on people's emotions. For instance, red will energize a person, but sustained exposure to red can make a person angry. And just as you talk about phased lighting that circadian lighting that oscillates throughout the day or changes according to time of day or mood of the office place. I don't think we could do the same thing with color, although there, with all the talk of intelligent materials, I'm wondering if how much research you know about that's been done with regard to color and whether color can someday be phased over the course of a day once we have intelligent materials or even adding some element of color to lighting.
Yeah, I have to admit I'm not up an expert on my color lighting research. However, the creators of the well building standard were, and we do have interventions related to and things that you can do and actions you can take related to color and lighting. Yeah, the technology does exist to be able to address some of that issue in concert with circadian lighting. So yeah, it's something that can definitely be done. And, you know, and actually, if that's not, since we're near the end, I want to just make one big thing. We've talked about the technology and the ventilation, and it sounds like a lot of this stuff is big technology or capital expenses. The real message that is that a lot of the stuff that creates health is really just about intent. Let's take fitness, right? Putting light and art and the stairwells, signage to get to the stairwells, nutrition, putting the bad stuff on the bottom shelf or behind a glass door, putting the good stuff up above, getting rid of, you know, vendor advertising, some policy stuff. There's just a whole bunch of the well-building standard is about doing what you already do. You already light and feed and water your people. You can do it with just where you put your drinking water and how you just things that you do. There's an amazing amount of passive things that are not costly that really are the heart of what this well-building standard is.
Our guest has been Scott Moldavin. He's senior advisor at Delos, a pioneer in the wellness real estate business and founder of the Well Building Standard. Scott, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thanks very much for taking the time to give us an explanation of this new frontier.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate your interest.